When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Dealing with pests can be a pain, but relax. Terminix can help.
Because when pests show up, so does Terminix.
With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast.
If your home or business has pests, don't stress it.
Terminix it.
Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today.
That's TERMINIX.com.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our guest producer, Mr. Matt Frederick. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. This is going to be one in what'll probably end up being a continuing series. If you saw the headline, it is companies started by cults. Run by cults, affiliated with cults. We all know that's a weird word. So use the phrase religious sect, if you wish, when you're talking with your family and friends over the holidays. Here's the story. A while back, we delved into the strange, at times intensely troubling story of a group called Falun Gong. They're a religious sect out of mainland China. They run, quietly run, the famous Shenyun Performance Group. And this got us thinking, many, many months back, what other companies and corporations might be associated with or even run by organizations that the average person would consider a cult? Here are the facts. First things first, we talked about this. Many, many companies are ultimately owned by the strangest entities, and you would not know this if you were just walking by them in your department store, you were clicking and buying stuff online. I think a lot of it is due to brand acquisitions, right?
So much. When you look at the manufactured foods businesses that are out there and how many of them got purchased by like big tobacco back in the day, if you really thought about that, you might not buy some of the snacks you go to the store and buy every week.
Not my jerky.
Oh, man, not just the jerky, the fast food outfits, cereal companies. I mean, so many can look like their own independent things. I only drink Lipton tea, someone might say, because it is, it is the tea that I like out of all the teas in the world. And you might think this is an independent thing, right? These companies are like, hey, Ben and Jerry, they own the only ice cream that I will eat. It's somehow different and better. But what you'll find is a lot of these that seem to be competitors, they have the same bosses.
It's the same with like craft breweries, right?
Right.
Like you'll have a craft brewery that does really well, and then all of a sudden Bushmills swoops in and grabs them, but they do it with very little fanfare because they're relying, nay, hoping, you know, that folks won't realize that the switcheroo has taken place.
100%. You know, a great example of this would be a corporate behemoth like Unilever. They own Dove. They own Axe. They own Lipton. They own Ben & Jerry's. They also own Walls Ice Cream, Hellman's, everything Hellman's makes, Vaseline. They own Slim Fast. And like you can see how it gets so confusing when these large companies interact. Unilever isn't just the owner of Lipton. It is the co-owner. Another big company, PepsiCo. PepsiCo owns everything, right? Didn't they own Tyco, which was always like the second run to Lego?
I think Tyco just kind of made like just general run-of-the-mill kind of children's toys. They were kind of boxy and Lego adjacent, but like not as intricate.
I know that Tyco, I always associated them with the sort of military indoctrination toys that are really common in the U.S. You build tanks with Tyco, right? Just like G.I. Joes, which I always thought were awesome, are there to make you very pro-military. But another thing Pepsi owns, Lipton. Weirdly enough, they co-own Lipton with Unilever. And I like the point that you have made, Noel, about brands and the power they have. Brands are popular. They command loyalty. So if you're a corporation and you're buying a brand, you're buying this image and you want to manage it. So like the average person isn't walking in and thinking, oh, I love buying Unilever brand ice cream, or hey, I only drink Unilever tea, right? That's why it's not on the packaging.
It is in like super fine print.
Yes.
You know, if you really want to dig for it or do your homework, you can figure out what these where these threads go, you know, what these org charts look like. And, you know, as we've discussed in a lot of corporate conversations that we've had on the show, those org charts usually kind of go back to one or two or three entities. And it really starts to make you think about things like political parties, you know, because it's all kind of, what do we say we were hanging this weekend, Ben? Fingers on a glove, you know, like it really is kind of that same example here.
Fingers on a hand. Yeah. Yes, sir.
It's one big funnel.
It's
operative word being fun.
Right? Yay.
Yeah. Oof.
And sometimes they take the L as well. I mean, this isn't necessarily sinister, but it is misleading. A lot of people only become aware of these huge portfolios and these ultimate owners when you see a boycott go viral and start making the rounds, right? Someone says, hey, we need to boycott Nestle, for instance. And someone says, okay, that's fine. I can go without Nestle Crunch Bar. And they say, wait, here's the full list of all the stuff that company owns. And then, you know, it's a ephemeral social media post. So it usually gets ignored in about 48 to 72 hours, like everything else. But
it's one of those things, Ben. It feels like it's not a shadow move to not openly promote brands as the mothership, you know, ownership company. But it does feel, you're right. It's a move, right? It's a strategic move to diversify the likes of your consumers so that they do latch onto those things. But it does feel like it's hidden purposefully.
It does. There's marketing to, I mean, like, okay, if you're familiar with military products or military rations, you know, what's the alternative? Would everything just be an identical packaging that was stamped like product 0612AZ, powdered potatoes, Unilever, or something like that? People wouldn't buy it.
Right. And the big, you know, corporate overlords, PR teams, when pressed on this, would likely argue, no, this is a service. You know, we're serving different segments. We're serving different needs. And it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. So it's not appropriate for us to brand, you know, something that's more specific to a women 18 to 32, cosmetic product with the Unilever stamp, you know, because...
Like Tresemme?
Yeah, right, exactly. That's its own wing that has its own aesthetics and its own consumers that we are here to appeal to. And we're not obfuscating. We're not being dishonest. You can totally find that we are the parent company, but that's sort of missing the point. Again, I'm speaking from the perspective of the parent company here.
Yeah, I think there is some rationale going into it. But I also like the phrase of, instead of a wing, another tentacle, if you will. But either way, still alarmingly Cthulhu-esque. This thing, though, now we're talking about it, guys, it makes me yearn for a world where products do have that backstage information printed right on the front. Like, I want the demographic there. I want to know, yeah. right? Oh, this is actually for people who are, you know, 18 to 54 who are for some reason very, you know, left-handed. I want to do that. Like, I want all that information.
This is Unilever real mayonnaise.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And this, is it for the benefit of the consumer? I would say maybe, but not necessarily. That's kind of a convenient thing to argue. But it gets even trickier when we realize that some of these companies who make things you will run across every single day in the West, they have association with things that would surprise you. And it goes far beyond global corporations trying to pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. There are a lot of religious sects that have incredible influence on products that you buy every day, and therefore incredible influence on you. And it's stuff they don't want you to know about pretty often because it might affect their bottom line. And, you know, again, real quick, whenever we talk about these things, we know the C word, cults, can be a little dirty, and a lot of groups that you would consider cults will take umbrage. They'll be offended if you call them that. So we'll go with the phrase religious sects or cults. We're just using that for the sake of communication in most cases here. So we're saying that out front just to make sure that if you're a member of these sects and you're listening, you know that we are describing statements of critics. We are describing statements of supporters. But as always here on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, we are, I would say, spiritual libertarians. We do not denigrate other people's personal beliefs so long as you're not hurting other people, right? That's pretty fair, right? Spiritual libertarian. I don't know if I love that phrase. We'll workshop it.
Universal Unitarian
Church of Light.
Yeah, there you go.
For all people.
There we go. So we started digging into this, and we started asking ourselves, just how common is this? What we're going to do now is introduce you to a few of these companies, and maybe at the end we can answer the question, how many, like, corporations and companies are really being run or influenced in some way by cults? Here's where it gets crazy. The answer, tons and tons, like way more than even we would have ever suspected. So many that we're not going to get to all of them today, but I say we give it a go. I mean, they're not all owned by cults, right? Some are just inspired by or influenced by or... Founded by.
Yes. Let's get started with one that I quite enjoy. And I didn't know anything about the stuff we're about to discuss. A little tea that I have purchased numerous times in my life. Different types of tea. Teas that make me get all sleepy. A little thing called Celestial Seasonings.
Great name. Mm-hmm. Great name. The Celestial Seasonings and Sleepy Time Tea. Back in the day, it's 1969, people are still kind of high, not a pun, off the off free love, the flower power movement, stuff like that. And they say, hey, maybe if we just put out enough good vibes, we can change the world. This is something also that made the FBI and the Alphabet Boys super pissed and uncomfortable. Yeah. And they started really doing some dirty work. In the flower power movements. So these hikers, these herbalists, especially one guy named Mo, they're not worried about that. They are inspired by the natural wilds of Colorado. And in 1972, they make this stuff that our very own Matt Frederick loves, Sleepy Tam Tea. I don't know why I sound so South Park there, but Sleepy Tam Tea. And
giving me the vapors of that accent, Bill.
And they became the most profitable tea outfit in all of North America. You can find it in any grocery store, right? Like it's kind of always in the tea section.
Is it the one with the bear? There's a bear and one of those like old timey night caps, the little dangly boys, you know, and then like the gown, and he's snuggled up with the good old cuppa.
Yeah, it's so common that it's one of those things where you would be more likely to notice if it were not in your tea section. Sort of like you'd be in a grocery store and you'd say, hey, why don't they have Heinz ketchup? You know, it's just everywhere.
Yeah, the sleepy time lavender, I think, was the one that got me there. There's one, I know there's at least one that has a dragon on the face of it. And I really enjoyed that marketing.
How celestial, right?
Yeah.
Because what do you think of when you think of tea? Dragons.
Well,
I do want to say, if anyone's watched Deadwood, the term celestial is actually used as a derogatory racial slur for Asian people.
Oh.
In that era. And again, I'm not saying there's any connection there, but it is interesting. And I'm sure the dragon is on some manner of green tea or some sort of, you know, capitalizing on like Eastern herbal remedies or whatever.
Interesting to raise the component of racism here, and we'll see why. Okay, this guy Mo Siegel, co-founder, and he's the idea man, right? He's the dude who's bringing together the herbs and making these wonderful teas. He was inspired by his friends and by Colorado, but he was also inspired by a book, a very long book. It's 2,000 pages. It's called the Urantia book. Urantia was first published in 1955. Officially, there's a lot of speculation about who wrote it, but it's like one of those, in the world of prophecy, it's something that would be called a direct speech book. The author, whomever they are, was divinely communicated with, right? And the truth, the metaphysical truth of reality and all that we know was shared to this person who wanted to illuminate the rest of not only Earth, but the known universe. So aliens were the ultimate authors through somebody else.
Well, yeah. And in the book, most of the major characters from the past, from like the Bible, mostly Bible stories, like everyone from Jesus to Adam and Eve, they were all allegedly aliens, like extraterrestrials who came to share a specific tale with the Earth.
Love it. So far, no notes. I'm in. But okay, so if we look a little bit more secular, then you'll see the majority of folks who have looked into this book in particular, this tome, they say it was written by a psychiatrist named William Sadler. Sadler was inspired by the Seventh-day Adventist movement. And first off, this book might not be for you. That's fine. You know, Twilight isn't for everybody, me included. But there's nothing wrong with loving a good book, you know, even if your friends don't like it. The thing is that critics and people outside of the movement who have read the book say that it has deep roots in eugenicism and eugenics parent company, white supremacy. It describes these Aryan aliens named Adam and Eve who are going to arrive on every planet to purify it, to upstep is the phrase they use, to upstep the civilizations overall to a newer, better, purer place. And Mo Siegel, you can read interviews or hear interviews with him where he says, initially, I thought, you know, this was out there, whatever. But as he read it, he became so inspired that it guided how he ran Celestial Seasonings. He was inspired to name the company based on the stuff he read in this book. And he had quotes from the book on the products. And it was like the moral compass for himself and his employees. This is not us casting aspersion. Mr. Siegel has said this multiple times. He is 10 toes down. He is on board. We even have a quote from him where he talks about this, and he seems very sincere.
He says, I had wanted bold. I found bold. I wanted spiritual adventure, and I was on the ride of my life. I was searching for truth, and the book was loaded with it. And like you're getting to, Ben, the Urantia book really is fodder for its own episode. But we'd like to describe it again, you know, objectively without imposing any judgment of any kind on it and misrepresenting the beliefs that are proposed within it. So once again, let's let Siegel himself do that job for us. He goes on to write, Lucifer, Satan, Melchizedek, Adam and Eve, and Jesus are all extraterrestrial beings who have visited Earth.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
I love a Melchizedek shout-out, man. That's such a mysterious character.
What is that?
It's some sort of spirit, I imagine, or some sort of like a Dybbuk or something. Like what is it? Like a
priest of the Most High God mentioned in the Old Testament, and he was revered by Abraham. Abraham even like paid tithes to this guy, and he was both a king and a priest. There's a lot of speculation about this dude, apocryphal, I don't know. You see conversations about it in all three of the Abrahamic religions, but I have some weird personal takes on Melchizedek, which are not for here, not for today.
For some reason, I was misconstruing that with Marduk, who is kind of like a god from ancient Mesopotamia, and also has been, you know, looked at as being something of a malevolent spirit.
Yeah, like a lot of the pre-Christian gods, that guy got his reputation smeared and became a demon, right?
By the way, just wanted to really quickly say that the dragon tea is called tension tamer. So it's not, you know, but there are some kind of Asian imagery, like a temple kind of thing, and this sort of classic Chinese looking dragon. But I didn't want to imply that there was this inherently any kind of racial undertones in that name.
And it might not have been conscious either, you know, just because we're talking about passage of a span of decades. But yeah, the strangest origins, right, to the most common sounding or innocuous sounding things. So this book is long, as we said, and it's kind of like, think of it in quarters and four parts. So the first three parts describe the metaphysical layout of the universe. They don't mention tea, I should say that. They're more about reality and the universe. And then the last fourth is a recounting of the life of Jesus Christ in detail. And now the book has been translated into 20 different languages. So if you do not, easily read English, never fear, you will find it in Arabic, Croatian, Chinese, Spanish, Italian, you name it. You know what I mean?
Yay. I don't know. It seems like a fun read to me in the way a science fiction novel would be. Because, you know, it goes into a lot of stuff. There's like invisible angel-like creatures, the seraphim, right? It paints a world that is much more interesting than the somewhat mundane place that we find ourselves in that does have incredible human beings doing all kinds of cool things and, you know, mind-blowing animals and plant life. But it's just, it's got this extra layer of excitement, I think, when you add that spiritual layer, thinking about what humans really are, right? This other spiritual side to all of us.
Yeah, in this philosophy, folks like the Jesus Christ of Christianity are, they're kind of like local representatives, and there are multiple ones on multiple planets. There are a billion worlds. And when the universe-wide evolution is complete, each of those worlds will have 100,000 local universes, each of which will have 10 million inhabited planets. Earth's real name, again, in this book, is Urantia, and it's number 606 in a planetary group called Satania, spelled like Satan, I-A. And the headquarters of this is Jerusalem. And when you die, you actually get reincarnated on a different planet. You go planet to planet to planet until you ascend to paradise, right? So there's a little bit of Eastern religion in here too. And that's where you run into the final boss of everything, known as the deity with a capital D. And you've been carrying a little piece of this deity in you. You know how you'll hear other belief systems say everybody has a piece of God in them, you know, and that's like the soul. Well, that's Urantia's answer to this. Your deity that lives inside you, kind of like a guardian angel or a symbiote, is called a thought adjuster.
I don't like that one.
Sleepy time tea.
Thought adjuster.
Yeah. So Siegel does, you know, clearly believe in this. He ultimately shifted his focus from tea altogether. He retired from Celestial Seasonings in 2002 and took over running the Urantia Foundation.
Went all in. Okay.
Went all in. And at this time, there haven't been, you know, allegations of a lot of gross mistreatment or anything, but there, but I think a lot of people would be surprised at the origin story of something that is as seemingly unobjectionable as a tea company. And we're kind of easing in. This is not the weird one. This is not the weird one, oddly enough. We're going to pause for a word from our sponsors, and then we'll be back into the world of education.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On-demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel.
Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
So tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
All right, and we have returned, and we are jumping into the world of education. We're also jumping into a world that may be dealing with some pretty intense subjects, like potential abuse of children, potential abuse like physical, mental, and sexual abuse. So just be aware of that as we jump into this. Parents out there, we are talking about an educational, let's say, service, piece of software. So you might be very interested in it. You just probably don't want your kids to be listening. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about education and the Acelus Academy.
Yeah, okay. Online learning tool made by a private company and sold to thousands of school districts across the United States. And that's pretty common. You know, your local school districts will always have contracts with third-party private entities that supply stuff a school needs to run. Whether you're talking about Cisco supplying food for the cafeteria, whether you're talking about deals with textbook companies, right, like Pearson to get all the biology textbooks out, that kind of stuff, very common. Acelus kind of fits into that fold, into that rough category. Its parent company is something called the International Academy of Science. Both Acelus and this International Academy are owned by a fellow named Roger Billings, who you may have never heard of. If you ask Roger, he is a scientist, he is an entrepreneur, and he is very much not the leader of an offshoot of the Mormon Church, which is called the Church of Jesus Christ in Zion. Former members say he's very much definitely in charge of it, and it is a polygamist cult.
Yeah. And there's a lot you should know. By the way, Roger Billings, he's got an honorary doctorate, I think. That's what they called it, from the International Academy of Science, which sounds so legit if you just say all those words together.
I love science. What could go wrong?
International? Incredible. Mm-hmm. And it's an academy?
Yeah. And he owns it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and they developed this thing called Acelus.
Yeah. So he's been, he and his organizations have been accused of some pretty nasty stuff, forcibly separating families, abusing children in horrific ways, and forcing people to conduct unpaid labor, so essentially enslaving people, and violently retaliating with any dissent or criticism. They've got three big communities there in Missouri, and one of them, how James Bond is this, one of them is an underground cavern system. The guy has an underground cave where people think he does the majority of running his companies, including Acelus.
It's an old limestone mine.
Yeah, right. People in there sleep in bunkers, basically. They work for free. And Billings has been accused of vigilantly scrolling through the internet to scrub it of any information that connects him to Zion, the religious sect. And everybody, again, he says no affiliate, he doesn't lead it or whatever. But on the other side, everybody else, from former members of the organization to experts on cults, say, yes, he 100% still leads it, and the various objectionable practices continue today. This comes out, a lot of it came out, or came to public light due to some stuff that went down with him in Hawaii's education system.
Is this similar? Is this in any way related to, you know, being a Zionist? You know, he uses the term, gets thrown around a lot these days, and I think a lot of people don't know what it means. I think it's used somewhat loosely and offensively at times, too.
I would say, just from what I've read, no. Doesn't have anything to do with Zionism. It's very different, and it's very weird. One of the some of those allegations that the criticism that came up through Hawaii's education system, because it was widely accepted in Hawaii, a lot of that came from allegations made by one of Billings' children. And there's a blog post you can find. The original one got deleted, and then the archive.org backup got deleted, but then it got reposted again, and you can still find it. It's some pretty serious allegations, and stuff that we talked about on this show a lot when it comes to how a cult leader controls human beings and what they do. But it goes pretty in depth on some things. Just practices of making sure that the person who's running the show gets to kind of be with whoever they want to be with, and everybody else kind of has to toe the line when it comes to relationships, when it comes to, you know, turning into an adult and the procedures that go down that are not good.
Yeah. And that's really common That's one of the more toxic behaviors of cultic organizations, right? Please do check out our video. It's years old now, but it holds up, like how to start a cult, how to run it. You will see that a lot of these organizations, like just how fascism can't really be defined by a singular ideology. It must be defined by its tactics. Cultic organizations are best defined by their tactics, their practices, what they do to eliminate the personalities and independence of their followers, right? And further subsume their egos and their agency into that of the leader. Billings does seem to be doing this, at least according to his critics. And again, all the survivors, there's no one who's come out of this cult and said, hey, it was great. It was just the scheduling that got me because I go bowling on Tuesdays. Nothing like that. It's much more sinister. And the Hawaii thing actually came out because Wall Street Journal ran a piece on this too. They had the parents and teachers in Hawaii said this program, their Acelus Learning Accelerator had a lot of sexist and racist content in it that was being taught to children. So they weren't like they learned of the cultic connection after they said, what are you teaching our children? You know, it's pretty weird stuff.
Well, ultimately, it strikes me as just maybe amateurly done. Like some of the animation that's, I've seen some videos of the animation that's in there of the voiceover work, just the way it's built. It just feels like it wasn't made by professionals. And that's, you know, I don't know who, you know, I don't know the individuals who actually made those things, who recorded those things and animated them. I just know that it feels like it was kind of thrown together. And maybe there wasn't a lot of oversight when it came to some of the content. That's what it feels like to me. But it doesn't feel like it's trying to indoctrinate anyone, like at all. I would not characterize it as that.
Agreed. Right. One of the big things in the Hawaii case was the way the history of Hawaii was being presented. Like Acelus was telling children the islands were discovered by Europeans in 1778. Anybody who has, you know, who has descended from the people of Hawaii knows that folks were living there thousands and thousands of years before that, right? So it's they got accusations of whitewashing, right? And if you've ever visited Hawaii, if you have family there, if you yourself are Hawaiian, you know that is an incredibly, that is a fundamental part of Hawaiian identity, the true story of Hawaiian past. So to sort of whitewash it, it's very, very sensitive. Not a good look. But yeah, I think you make an excellent and very fair point, Matt, that there was not open indoctrination. People were just objecting to using taxpayer dollars for this. And then they found out about the cult. So it was very much a, but wait, there's more moment.
Yep. And if you want to read the allegations that were put forward by Aaron Billings, a child of Roger Billings, you can just search Aaron Billings blog, and hopefully you can find it. We found it on Google Photos, of all things, because someone made them public and put it back up online.
Right. Again, people are, you're going to see that there's a cycle of stuff about this place getting posted and then removed and then reposted. There's also a great investigation by Sarah Emerson and Matthew Giles, writing for 10s. Just do their names and 10. Written out, and you'll find it. And that might be an episode of its own. It might be an episode that finally lands us in papers of note, like the Washington Times, not to be confused with the Washington Post. You guys know we've used the Washington Times as a source before.
We have.
Yeah, if they are, because they're a conservative paper out of D.C., and they have an emphasis on U.S. politics. So so in the past, I can't remember which stories it was specifically, we were looking into, I think, some controversies with some U.S. politicians, and they had some pretty good reporting on this. I mean, it was definitely slanted. They definitely have, you know, their agenda or their horse in the race, but they had some good reporting, and they have been considered a paper of note, but they're pretty clear in terms of their focus and the way they frame perspectives, right? Like, these are not the folks who are going to be warning about the dangers of climate change so much as the folks who will be saying, climate change, that's a little overhyped. It's that kind of paper. It was also founded by the Unification Church.
That sounds familiar. What is that?
Moon. It is an organization that does not like being called a cult. One, it is not based in the U.S. It is based in Korea. It was founded by a guy named Sun Myung Moon in 1954.
Ah.
The Moonies.
Yep.
The Moonies own the Washington Times.
The Moon, it's kind of like a sort of a dated organization. You hear it like referenced in like 80s movies a lot, but you don't really hear it come up much, you know, these days. Am I right?
They're still active, but yeah, they're not in pop culture as much as they definitely were. Like, you don't, you know, in the days of Carson, you would hear Moonies and Hare Krishnas referenced, right? Often in the same jokes.
For like passing out pamphlets at the airport and stuff.
Yeah, stuff like that. And this group is probably, during that time too, when they were more in the zeitgeist, they were best known for mass arranged marriages. And you can see photos of like tons and tons, like more than 100 couples getting married at once. This is also you could call it a new religious movement if you don't want to use the word cult or sect. This is what's called a Messiah claimant movement, which is the more academic way of saying the person in charge thinks that they are the Messiah, usually the second coming of Christ in some variety. Also, just for the record, I feel like dude is a unisex term here in American English.
These days.
Right? Yeah, I mean,
well, you know, the joke used to be dude and dudette, dudes and dudettes, but now dudette is like diminutive and kind of offensive. So I think we can all say dudes, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's, even my kid confirms that she believes it's non-gendered.
But then what about bros?
Bro, it depends on how you use it in the context,
you
know?
It does.
It really does. A lot of it has to do with context. Can I say really quickly, you know who my favorite Messiah is? I've been digging back into some Stephen King short stories. Uh-huh. Remember He Who Walks Behind the Rose?
Oh, yeah. Adapted to Children in the Corn.
Well, no, that's the character.
The story was adapted to Children in the Corn, but He Who Walks Behind the Rose is the local Cantok, I think.
Correct. This is this kind
King
of,
would call
you
it.
Know, weirdo, you know, demon messiah that these like feral fundamentalist children worship and sacrifice tourists to.
Yeah, Cantok in the Stephen King universe is a big god. I think Kanto is like a smaller. We'll figure it out. It's all Ka is a wheel. I love that stuff too. Like it's strange with this because we see that cults often do kind of try to portray their leader or their figurehead at least as divinely inspired and possessed of supernatural abilities. The Unification Church, especially during Moon's lifetime, was very much in step with that. He was based in the Christian Bible originally, but then, you know, kind of did his own thing. Very Fleetwood Mac, go your own way when you start a cult.
Absolutely.
So this isn't a story the Washington Times will tell you very often, you know, because just like how Unilever would rather you think Ben and Jerry's is its own thing. You know, the key in journalism, the ideal in journalism, is that something should be relatively independent, like ProPublica. Look at all the excellent work they do. But the reality is a lot of these papers of note can be heavily influenced by three big things. One, the political ideas and other investments of their owners. Shout out to the Hearst Enterprise. Two, the economic heft of their advertisers. That's a huge thing. And then, of course, three, the one that people don't like to talk about, even in the States where freedom of press is a big thing, the FBI, CIA, all of, they have this network of contacts where they go to the editors or they go to the shareholder, they go to the board and they say, okay, you guys are a free press. So you're totally, we'd rather you not report some things, but if you must, this is the way you're going to talk about them. And they do it.
Well, just quickly, let's talk about how this organization, it's kind of strange organization, ended up creating a right-wing newspaper. Well, there were missionaries that the Moonies or Moon himself sent to the United States back in those times, the 1960s, when minds were a little malleable in these ways, at least over here. And they established a pretty strong following in the U.S. And then they moved into basically, I guess it's news. I guess it's more of a media organization, right, Ben, where they're doing all kinds of stuff, but mostly propaganda for themselves, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They want to have a megaphone. They want to have a loudspeaker, right, in the field of public discourse. They've been pretty successful, too. Just through the Times, for instance, as of last year, the paper had a daily circulation of 50,000. People are reading it, you know, and they can become a thought leader in the space, especially with their demographic. But still, you have to ask yourself, okay, is this just a money-making endeavor? Is this just a financial decision to, you know, support the continuation of the organization, which happens all the time? Or is this a way for the message to spread, right? What's the end goal? Is it to make money or is it to grow the organization or is it both? That's the concern, especially when you're talking about news, right? Will the Washington Times ever report a scandal in their parent organization? Maybe not. Maybe not. And with that, we're going to pause. These are still not the weirdest ones, by the way, folks. These are just kind of obfuscating their ultimate owners. But after a word from our sponsor, we're going to go to the dinner table.
Yeah.
Maybe your grandmother's dinner table.
And the deli.
And the deli. Yeah, and the deli.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel.
Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
So tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're back. Okay, Onita, New York, this one's for you. If you are from this area, you already know what we're going to talk about, but tell yourself it's because you have psychic powers instead of, you know, knowing one of the biggest stories to come out of that part of the U.S. Onita Silverware. They make cutlery, knives, forks, spoons. You've probably
sporks.
Seen them. Maybe sporks. No, I don't know. They're
sure.
A little classy
no,
for sporks.
Yeah, these things are upscale,
yeah.
Dude.
Yeah, they're upscale, but they're kind of staid. You know what I mean? Like
Maybe like those serrated knives that come in kind of a wooden case, you know, set that you see in like really fancy table spread photography for magazines a lot, stuff like that.
Yeah, and you can go to their website, which is just onita.com, and you can see any number of stuff they make. Like just for a quick snapshot, you know, they got different levels of sets you can buy. Their Michelangelo 53-piece flatware set is apparently supposed to be $600-something dollars, and now it's $300 just in time for the holidays.
Guys?
Yeah.
Silverware currently in my house? Onita.
Sweet.
Oh, thank
fancy.
You for your support. Yeah.
You can get a 20-piece set, though, of a fine flatware service for four for a mere $154. So that's on the lower end, you know.
Yeah. They've got something for everybody in the market, right? That's their idea. And, you know, sometimes these silverware sets are wedding gifts, right? This is the kind of thing you might see on a wedding registry. They're very well established. They're everywhere. But I would say they're nice. They're like, as you said, Matt, they can be upscale. It's kind of like a little run of the mill, a bit staid nowadays. It's nice the way like a Lincoln car might be, right? You say, okay, this is cool, but it might be a little bit of an older crowd, right? Maybe more of a grandmotherly demographic, you know?
Yeah, for sure. They also have like, you know, serving sets and things like that. They're a little bit more old school, right? And I was even, what I was saying earlier was not even quite on the mark. Those serrated knives, they don't even sell steak knives, really. They mainly just sell your traditional kind of table set stuff.
Yeah, and they have, you know, knife sets and they've expanded because they've been around for so long. They were actually founded as a result of a crisis because when the folks who would end up creating this silverware company got together, they were not concerned with the state of cutlery in the United States. They were way more into radicalizing fundamental opinions about relationships. Starts with a guy named John Humphrey Noyes. Sadly, that's Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S. I think Noyes would be a cool last name, just like sound. But he created this group, a commune called the Onita Community. This is probably its own episode. We may have did something like this in Ridiculous History. The group never got really big. At its height, we're talking around 300 people. And they were scandalous in their day because they practiced what they called complex marriage. Noyes also coined the term like free love.
Yeah. I was going to say complex marriage sounds like a bit of a diplomatic term for something else.
Yeah, right. It sounds like something like a royal biographer who would be afraid of pissing off the crown. He would say, it was often noted that the king and his bride had a complex marriage.
Yeah, it's like that Facebook status. It's complicated.
Oh,
know?
Boy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So complex marriage is the idea that love is great and you shouldn't restrict your affection to just one person. You know, society's got all these rules. Let's do free love, you know. And that meant that anyone could have a sexual relationship with any other consenting person. In fact, monogamy was frowned upon. Monogamy was seen as kind of like selfish and self-limiting. But despite saying they were going to fight against the rules of the establishment, they didn't go super free, actually. They created their own system of very complex and highly enforced rules. And it was In full disclosure, it would be considered incredibly predatory and abusive today. If you're an adolescent boy, you are told to engage in sexual behavior with women over 40 who function as mentors to you. So they would teach you religious principles. It would also initiate you into the world of sex. And the reason the women were supposed to be over 40 is because, in John Humphrey Noyes's opinion, that minimized the chance of the relationship resulting in pregnancy. And then older men were doing the same thing with adolescent females. And as the head honcho, Noyes is the one who often declared who could sleep with whom.
Yeah, that's also a hallmark of the cult leader, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So as we see, there's this emphasis on controlling not just romance, but controlling procreation, right? So they practice a couple of different methods. You may have heard the phrase coitus interruptus, aka the pull-out method, before, right? Any number of times. As a lot of people can assure you from personal experience, that is not a 100% effective method. But they also practice something that I think stood out to us called coitus reservis, coitus reservatus. Weird Harry Potter spell. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, just
Patronus expectoronius, coitus interruptus.
Coitus reservatus.
That's a really fun thing to yell out, though, in that moment.
Oh, in that moment? Exactly.
Coitus interruptus.
Yeah, try to cast the list.
It leaves a weird residue when you cast it.
But so this reservatus idea was, it was kind of based on these older religious or spiritual beliefs, I would say, that a dude's ejaculation, a man's ejaculation, was part of his virility, right? And so by reserving that, by not actually reaching ejaculation, the person who practiced this would stay even more virile.
Yeah, this is like the same concept as like tantric sex or whatever, mm-hmm. like in some Eastern cultures. The idea
Shout
of
out
like,
to Gordon. Sorry, correct. Sting.
Yes, of course. Yeah. The idea that by withholding or holding back, I guess, you are in fact increasing your sexual prowess and strength.
Yeah. So they were into that. They had a lot of rules. Let's say you do want to have a child, right? And you met someone and you just know it's a perfect match. Well, then you and your partner have to go to a committee. They loved committees in this community. You have to apply for permission. It was a whole thing. They also had these mutual criticism meetings, which were just like they sound, another effective way of controlling the minds of cult members. So you might say, hey guys, you're going into a lot of detail about this, and so far it has nothing to do with silverware. You're right.
Yep.
It wasn't until the start of the Civil War that the group realized they were in hot water.
This is all before the Civil War. Everyone.
This all happened before the Civil War. Yes, yes. So they had a lot of members, but when you join the organization, you give up the vast majority of your personal property, right? All but the basics.
Another hallmark of a cult.
Absolutely. And they had these members, but they had a huge financial problem. They didn't have a lot of cash. People had already given up their stuff, so they didn't have, you know, necessarily rich benefactors that could be brainwashed into footing the bill. So they said, we're going to move as a unit. We're going to exercise the power of the commune. They tried to grow and sell fruit, but they were in upstate New York, and the harsh winters made that difficult. So they tried out some other things. They made leather bags. They made different kinds of sort of fine fabrics. And then because the fur trade was really big, they made metal traps. Now, it goes without saying that the people of the community often weren't going to wear this finery themselves, right? Just like how a lot of the regions of the world that produce the best coffee, the folks who actually work on those fincas or plantations, they rarely, if ever, get to taste the coffee that they're growing. Same thing with chocolate. So they're kind of in a situation like that. Anyway, it's 1877. This stuff is helping them get by, but it's not really working out. And the commune's in danger. And there's a guy who's a member of the commune, Robert Wayland Smith, I want to say. He's sitting on this riverbank, just whiling away the day. And before whiling meant partying hard. He's just in a state of rest. And
yeah, more like the scarecrow, whiling away the hours, consulting with the flowers.
Just so. And he sees a silverware factory nearby, and he literally thinks, hey, we're on the same river. I bet we could make silverware. You know, we already make metal traps. We work with metal. Why not? And shortly thereafter, Oneida is full-time into the silverware business, and they're reaching a lot of success. But with their financial success came social unrest. The community collapsed because this was a controversial approach to romance. And, you know, not to mention this child abuse. Local authorities started passing laws that explicitly banned the Oneida commune's approach to relationships.
Well, adultery was a crime then.
Right. Yeah.
So literally any of the activities outside of their marriage and with anyone in that community would have, they could have gotten in some serious trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's the thing. The leader skips town. He's already not doing well health-wise. He's actually deaf by this time. He just leaves. He ghosts and he moves to Canada. Former members know something's in the wind. They know the thing is starting to, things are starting to fall apart. The center cannot hold, you know, Falcon's turning into Geyer and so on. And they say, okay, let's just have more traditional relationships. And so they partner up and they leave and they, you know, start their own lives outside of this. Ultimately, afterward, people decide, hey, we're going to start a corporation for the silverware, which is still doing gangbusters. We're not a commune anymore. We're a silverware company. And so they say, okay, let's figure out shares of this corporation. And it'll be based on how much you originally contributed to the community when you joined and gave up all your money and possessions. And then how hard you've worked at the silverware interest while you were a member. And in 1880, Oneida Community Limited was born. In all fairness, right now, if you go on their website, what you'll see is the company now has absolutely nothing to do with the practices of the commune.
How hard you worked, is that based on a specific metric of productivity, or is that up to the bosses to determine?
It's a little tough because it's a good question. It's a little tough because a lot of folks were only working just a few hours a day. So you would have to, without getting too into the nuts and bolts, you would have to assume that they had a little bit of corruption or a little bit of nepotism. I'm thinking that the shares were probably more predicated, at least in most cases, on how much money somebody bought in when they joined.
I see. So like Scientology rules.
No, it should be noted that when the factory was up and running early on, the actual community members wouldn't be the ones working in the factory, at least at most times. It would be hired help that came through and was actually running all the stuff. So yeah. It's interesting to think about. I wonder how much ownership everybody actually had, or, you know, how much hard work everybody actually put in. It's interesting.
And this, again, maybe a story that we join later. We do have to, again, note, like, unlike the Washington Times, unlike a couple of other companies in our conversation today, Oneida by itself just has its origins in a religious sect. It is no longer doing that today. But let's go to something different. Since we're already at a dinner table or a lunch table, and we're already thinking of cutlery, why don't we think about sandwiches? Who doesn't love a good deli? Ever been to the Yellow Deli website? We mentioned this briefly in a past conversation.
It reminds me of the Hello Deli, which is next to where the late show with David Letterman was shot. And he would always go down there and get mess with the guys at the Hello Deli. This is not that. The Yellow Deli. Yeah, it just kind of, you know, on first glance seems like sort of a hippie themed delicatessen vibe, which wouldn't be too far off if you read their About Us section on their website, which reads as follows. One day in 1972, a few zealous people had the thought they could open a little place where people could come and sit down, not feel rushed to leave. People could ask questions if they wanted to and could find a little refuge from the pressures of life. Well, sometimes it is hard to even find someone to talk to about our troubles. Being believers, these young zealots, there's that word again, knew that there really are answers to the troubles of man. Wait, this isn't a deli. This isn't deli talk. Do they have boar's head? Do they have their own other proprietary types of meats?
It's yellow deli talk. I like that they put this on their website, because what they're saying is they're acknowledging, yes, we are a deli, but we are a community, a commune, right? A people united by the same belief. And they even address how the employees live together in addition to working together. And it goes into some detail on the scriptural basis of their beliefs, because the Yellow Deli was established by the leaders of a religious sect called the 12 Tribes. 12 Tribes comes out of an earlier thing called the Jesus Movement, which was very focused on the Book of Acts. And the 12 Tribes says, look, we're going to try to accelerate the return of the Messiah, or I should say, we're going to hopefully make the return of the Messiah more welcoming by recreating the 12 ancient tribes of Israel.
How do you recreate that?
He had a lot of locations. There's one in Brunswick, Georgia.
There's one in Savannah, too, I think.
Yeah, I don't see Savannah. I see Chattanooga's real close to here.
Chattanooga's the one I've seen before,
Yeah, but then they've got some in Argentina. There's one in Australia, Brazil, British Columbia. Let's see, Manitoba, lots in Canada. There's one in Japan. They've got two in Spain and quite a few. Oh, no, just one in the United Kingdom, in Honiton in the UK, wherever the hell that is. And then, you know, about 10 or 12 or so in the US.
Yeah. As of just a couple of years ago, the 12 tribes, the movement, had about 3,000 members acknowledged in 50 different communities around the world. They have been under fire, unfortunately, for some things, including allegations that they have mistreated children, not the way the Anita commune did, but more by practicing a spare the rod, spoil the child approach to education and discipline. There have been accusations of daily beatings, of forced labor, unpaid in factories. And they respond to this on their about page. In a way that sounds pretty nice, saying, sadly, fear of evil or perverse behavior going on among us has caused some to circulate unfounded rumors about us, thinking we must have bad motives. We hope that through having an open and hospitable place like our Yellow Deli, people will be able to see that we're not really strange and scary, but just friendly folks who love God and our neighbors.
We're just friendly and scary. not strange at all. They've got some cute little logos though at the bottom of their page too. They've got one that's like two sheep holding hands with their arms around each other. That's kind of weird that it's sheep, given the reputation of sheep as animals, you know, being like, you know, blind followers or whatever. And then they've got another one that's like a rocking chair with an acoustic guitar and a mandolin draped over it, and like a old pair of boots, worn laced boots at the bottom of it. It is very homey. And they emphasize that their sandwiches are freshly hot steamed sandwiches, which is an old school style of deli service.
And the menu really has that 60s, 70s aesthetic vibe. I do want to say also, you know, this reminds me of some similar outfits here in Atlanta. Like I have long time been a customer of a place called Soul Vegetarian, which has two outfits here that I remember in our fair metropolis. And Soul Vegetarian is an extension of the Hebrew Israelites. Have you guys been to Soul Vegetarian?
I haven't, but I've heard of it. And I've heard actually quite good things about it.
There are several vegetarian vegan restaurants in the city that have an interesting connection to a very small religious movement.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. And this Soul Vegetarian, they are vegan comfort food, basically.
It's over in Virginia Highlands, right?
Mm-hmm. There's one there. There's one on the west side. And they're out of the Hebrew Israelite community of Jerusalem. Is what it's called.
There is a very sectarian church in Augusta, where I'm from, called the International House of Prayer for All People. It is a Christian, you know, themed, that's the wrong word, but it is a Christian sect, but there's a leader, and there are all these like portraits of this guy, and he got really long nails. He doesn't cut his nails. And apparently I haven't confirmed this, but like they'll wash his feet and bottle the water and sell the foot water. But here's the thing. It has the most incredible soul food cafe that's open to the public connected to it, with the best cornbread and like collards and just really, really amazing Southern food. And it's obviously a gateway in, you know, for the public at large. You know, you go in wanting to get some shrimp and grits, and maybe you leave slightly indoctrinated.
Checkers was right. You got to eat. You get people through those appeals to universal needs and commonalities. I do want to go back and just say real quick. Yeah, there have been multiple accusations of anti-Semitism on the Black Hebrew Israelite community. When I've been there, it's been perfectly fine. As a matter of fact, my only complaint is that there's not ice in the water. You know, and on the list of problems, I understand that's a very low priority. I'm just saying it gets hot here in the summer. But that's interesting, because in talking about Yellow Deli, we have already found two examples. We've had personal experience with two examples of other organizations that are doing something very similar. This shows you how common it can be for a religious sect to reach out to people in that way, or to support themselves. Now, there's so many we didn't get to. We talked about Narcanon previously. We'll probably save that for a part two. And in just the few examples we've explored today, we've seen they have some commonalities that should be addressed. First, is there anything wrong with a company being founded on spiritual or religious principles? No, 100% not. It's fine. Millions of groups across the world do this every day. Ton of them, I would even say the majority probably, are completely above board, and you can't discriminate against anyone for their personal beliefs unless, again, they're harming someone else or they're trying to force those beliefs on you. Then just don't mess with them. It's not worth it. And then secondly, I was thinking? A lot of the folks who are employees of these companies, especially the bigger ones, it's highly likely they're not members of an organization, and they might not even know about the affiliation or the origin story. But the one thing that's for sure is there are a lot of companies like this out here, and in many cases, their true affiliations right now remain the stuff they don't want you to know. Also, God, I want a sandwich now. What about you guys?
Yeah, I'm hungry.
I don't know if you guys have been through LaGuardia Airport recently, but like for a while, it was just this endless construction. Like it seemed suspicious how long that place has been under construction, but they finally finished Terminal C, and they've mm-hmm. got like some legit New York food options there now. And there's this one place that's like a classic. You can get like a classic Italian hoagie with like, you know, sesame seeds and the provolone and all the things with like arugula and like broccoli rabe and, you know, whatever. It's, oh my God. It's a whole new ball game at LaGuardia, y'all.
It's great. I was at LaGuardia just yesterday, and they had, and it was so much smoother.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking, like, what kind of dangerous game am I playing with the New York airports here, right?
You used to have to take a tram to the taxi station and the Ubers and stuff, but now it's just right outside. I mean, it was like, I've been flying into JFK because LaGuardia was such a show, but now it's like, right. I might just change that up. I think I like LaGuardia
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I think the move is to go with LaGuardia because construction started at JFK. The reason we're mentioning LaGuardia is because we wanted to end on this. As you probably know, folks, LaGuardia is wholly owned by former members of the Manson family. Don't fact check us.
Mm-hmm.
Just have Never. A great weekend. Matt, no, I'm sorry. I'm kidding. I think I'm kidding.
Oh, okay. Okay. Good.
So
you're talking about Squeaky Fromm.
All right. Yeah, so, yeah. Famous airline magnate.
The Squeaky Fromm gets the grease.
So, yeah, we're going to have a part two of this, maybe a part three. We would love your help. Let us know about some more organizations that have similar connections. We think it is important for this to be something that people can be aware of. You know what I mean? Whether you're talking sandwiches, whether you're talking educational online learning tools, who knew about that? We want to spread the word and we'd love your help. We try to be easy to find online.
Online.com is our website address. That's a thing. No, it's not. It is conspiracy stuff on Twitter and YouTube and Facebook, where we have a group called Here's Where It Gets Crazy Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. And by the way, man, Matt, it was a bummer you couldn't make it, but Ben and I had a little trip to New York we were just talking about, where we did a morning talk show, the Elvis Duran Show. And you can find a fun video of that on Instagram, on the Elvis Duran Morning Show Instagram account. I think it's posted on our page too, but we're talking about glitter. You know that's one of our favorites, but hope we did you proud, buddy.
You did. It's on TikTok right now. We have a TikTok channel.
TikTok, yeah.
Yeah. And it's getting all kinds of views and comments. You guys go check out our TikToks now.
And you may see us in more radio appearances in the near future. If you have a radio station that you want us to hop on, write to them or write to us and let us know. In the meantime, if you're already on board with contacting us, why not give us a phone call? The phone number 1-833-STDWYTK. You'll hear a familiar voice and a beep like so. Beep. And then you'll have 3 minutes. Those 3 minutes are yours. No one can take them from you. That's your country. You rule those 3 minutes. Go nuts with it. Give us a nickname that you like. Give us a cool AKA or street name. Tell us what's on your mind. Let us know if we can use your name and or message on the air. Most importantly, don't censor yourself. If you need more than 3 minutes, if you have some sources to share, please, please, please write us an email. We love it. We read every single one we get. All you have to do is drop us a line where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.